Do you like sports? Do you like art? What about science? Giraffes? Giraffe scientists that paint rugby games? It's all available on Audible, the biggest audiobook site with the largest selection of audiobooks this side of the inner solar system. No need to use your boring old eyes anymore. The ears are the future, my friend. Why, you're using them right now. So check out Audible and get your listen on. Go to www.readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to start your 30-day free trial today.
It's as if the youth are shouting at us, those of us who do have the power and do have the wealth and do have the influence, to pay attention to the future, to their future. Pay attention to our future.
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I'm your acclaimed host, John Banaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 63, where the days are getting shorter, but the nights are getting longer. As always, if you have ideas for books you'd like to see featured, or if authors you want to put me in touch with, you can reach me at jon@readlearnlivepodcast.com. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with author Ronald Rosbottom about his book, Sudden Courage, Youth in France Confront the Germans, 1940 to 1945. Ronald Rosbottom is the Winifred L. Arms Professor in the Arts and Humanities and a professor of French, European Studies, and Architectural Studies at Amherst College. Previously, he was the Dean of Faculty at Amherst. His previous book, When Paris Went Dark, The City of Light Under German Occupation, 1940 to 1944, was longlisted for the National Book Award in Nonfiction and was acclaimed as a landmark study, an intimate, sweeping narrative that reshaped our conception of the period. He divides his time between Amherst, Massachusetts, and Paris. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hello, everyone. My name is John Banaster, and this is the Read, Learn, Live podcast. I'm here today to talk to you about Sudden Courage, Youth in France Confront the Germans from 1940 to 1945. And I am so lucky to be joined today by Ronald. Ronald, say hello.
Hi, hello. I'm glad to be on your program.
Thanks so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to get to talk to authors. And Ronald Rosbottom, this book was just so intense and so interesting and really opened my eyes to a period of history that I had no idea about before, which is why I love reading. So thanks for taking the time to put this all together.
Well, it took some time, but it was worth it. It was a project I got interested in because I had written an earlier book about the occupation of the city of Paris, and I kept noticing how many young people were involved in resistance. So I said, if I write another book, I want to concentrate on the youth, and of course, we are still concentrating on youth today because all over the world, it's the youth who are leading major demonstrations for democracy and freedom and justice. So there is a connection between what happened in the 40s and what's happening today.
Sure. So, yeah, why don't we start off with just a quick summary, to the extent you can quickly summarize it, but, just tell everyone what the book is all about.
Well, the book is about what I said. What I discovered is that a large percentage of people who were in the resistance, and by the way, there wasn't a very large percentage of the total population in the resistance, despite what the French would like have you believe that everybody was in the resistance. It was really a relatively small number. But of that number, over half of them were under the age of 25. And so I wanted to know why. What compelled a young person, a student, a young worker, boys and girls, young men and women, to put their to interrupt their lives, their plans, their careers, and at first to do some modest resistance, passing out tracts and putting up signs on walls, and later become much more active in terms of using some sort of violence against the Germans. And I read a lot of memoirs, and I chose about a dozen or a little more, a dozen young people from different parts, different social groups, religions, immigrants, as well as French kids, and tried to present a kind of mosaic, a portrait of different reasons and different failures and different successes. And that's the book. The book emphasizes that demographic cohort of roughly 15 to 25 years old. The other interesting thing about this is that these years are very important years in our lives. It's when we grow from being boys and girls to young men and women. And so the war lasted roughly 5 years. And so during those 5 years, a young person could be like 13 when the war began and be 18 later, or be 16 and be 21 later. So parallel to their stories is an analysis of how growing into adulthood was also a factor in their success and their failure. So that essentially is what the book is about.
Sure. And before we get into all of that, I want to just take a quick step back. I always like to check in on the creative process. So, you know, knowing that you wrote your other book, When Paris Went Dark, maybe talk a little bit about why you wanted to focus in on this specific aspect of that, and then how you actually went about writing the book, and maybe the extent to which that was similar or different to your first book.
Well, I was not trained as a historian of the occupation in France. I was essentially, I had a PhD in Romance languages, and I've spent most of my career teaching French literature and culture, specifically of the 18th century, the Enlightenment. So how did I get into this subject? It was because of my love of Paris. I went abroad as a young man from Alabama who'd never been out of the South before and spent a year in Paris and fell in love with the city, and now I try to go back there at least twice a year. And I invented a course for freshmen here at Amherst College, which was the history of Paris in the last 150 years. The myths of Paris, the relationship between the imagined Paris and the real Paris. And I taught that course for 10 or 15 years, and I kept going back to Paris. And I began noticing when I was in Paris how much memory was embedded in plaques and in the walls and in the museums about the occupation. And so I said, I'd like to know more about that. And the result was it took me about 8 or 9 years to write my first book on this, When Paris Went Dark, and which was published about 5 years ago. And it was essentially my love of Paris that led me to this, this subject. Did a lot of research. I interviewed a lot of people, went to the archives, learned a lot about the resistance, and learned how little I really had known about the resistance. And the second book, which took me much less time to research and to write, because I had already done a lot of work for the for When Paris Went Dark, is an offshoot of that, and that is what motivates people to challenge power, especially when their lives could be at stake, and especially young people. And so I would say that it all began in Paris, that this interest, and then moved to a larger canvas, which was France in general.
Sure. Oh, that's a great starting point, though. Then to kind of lead into the book itself, I wanted to try and orient people, because this book is filled with all the various players,
right,
you know, that were involved in this occupation. There were so many different groups and people. So, you know, we've got the German military, the SS, the Gestapo, Vichy's government, the Gaulle and the Free French Forces, you know, PCF. So maybe if you could just briefly give us an overview of some of the major players here and how they all fit together within occupied France.
France was a major military power and was considered to have the largest and most best organized, best supplied army in Europe, even more than the German army. And everyone was going to rely on France and Britain, which had a very small army at that time, but had a large navy, to keep the Germans locked up in Germany, or at least on the western front, Western Europe. And then, you know, the history of Hitler pushing and pushing and adding Austria and parts of Czechoslovakia to the Third Reich, and then finally in September the 1st, 1939, declaring war on Poland. Everyone was still confident that France and England would come to the aid of Poland. They had a treaty with Poland and would stop Hitler in his tracks. Well, they didn't. There was such a legacy of such a memory of the tragedy of World War One that countries were very, very, these, France and England especially, were very, very reluctant to start another war. And they thought that if they could just stand where they were and act defensively, they could stymie Germany. Hitler decided to invade France. He thought the invasion would last a year, and it lasted 6 weeks. The world was stunned that France fell so quickly. It didn't fall because of lack of courage. It fell because of lack of primarily of leadership of the military and of a theory of war that was going to be defensive and not offensive. And so the Germans overtook Paris in 6 weeks. Churchill, who became prime minister on the very day that almost that the Germans invaded, couldn't believe it. He thought France was going to be the bulwark against German invasion of Western Europe. He flew into the great danger three times to Paris to ask them where their reserves were. What were they doing? I can't believe that you are retreating. And suddenly, France caved and signed an armistice with Germany that, in effect, was the only such armistice signed in World War II, in effect dividing the country into two parts, the northern part, which would be controlled totally by the Germans, and the southern part, which would be controlled by a quasi-fascist French government called Vichy, because that's the town in which it was founded. So suddenly, Britain finds itself all alone because the Netherlands and Belgium and France had been taken. And this surprised the whole world. The whole world was stunned by this. They couldn't believe it, that Paris was taken and that this massive French army had been outmaneuvered, essentially outmaneuvered by the Germans. And so that began the famous occupation. The Germans thought they could take England soon after, and then they would turn around and go back and start a war with Russia, because ultimately Hitler was planning on taking Western Russia. But the British Britain was not invaded. The English Channel, the English fleet, and kept Hitler from invading. So he had to keep a large number of Germans, a German army, in Germany for a long time, which meant that he couldn't invade Russia for at least a year after he had defeated the French. So that's basically the story. And the Germans stayed there in certain parts. Even at the end of the war, there were still certain German French cities held by the Germans. But then in November and June 1944 was the great D-Day invasion, which began to push the Germans out of France. But it took them a long time to do that because France is a very large country, and the Germans fought very well. But that's essentially now one of the big arguments in the French is where was France at this time? Was it in London where Charles de Gaulle, who went over as an unknown general, went over and broadcast that French should keep fighting? Or was it in Vichy, which was a legal government, legally installed by the legislature? And so there were two Frances at that point, the one in London, Free France, and the one in France called Vichy France. And that struggle was going on at the same time that the struggle between the Allies and the Axis powers was going on. So you see how complicated this is? I want to see how you edit this down into 3 minutes.
I don't know if it's possible. It sure is complicated, and I think that's one of the crucial things to understand is, you know, that there is no soundbite here because, you know, war is messy. And it's
very messy, and yes, it's historically messy in the sense that they are trying to remember it, but it's also while it's going on, it's messy. The Germans did not expect to have beaten the largest army in 6 weeks, and England thought it was going to be invaded for about 3 months after that. It literally thought it was going to be invaded. But these things keep changing, and it was
So we've got all this happening. So France has taken over. The world is shocked, and you know the citizens of France kind of feel a lot of citizens at first seemingly aren't so worried. Some people are,
right?
But, you know, it sort of was like slow and steady, and then this sort of resistance really kicked off, and I want to talk about the story of Guy Mouquet, if I'm pronouncing that right, and the resistance movement. So maybe talk about how the resistance really got started, and maybe even the idea that, you know, there kind of isn't just one resistance with a capital R, but there are lots of resistances across France at this time.
Right. Yes, that's a very good point. There were people who had to resist almost immediately, and these were immigrants who had come to France for safety after Hitler took power, socialists, communists, and especially Jews. They were immediately targeted by the Germans, and so immediately they had to go underground or hide. Then there was the French who were communists, and they had their own... they were fighting fascism in general. There were French who were pro-Vichy because, after all, that was a French government. It was a conservative government. It wanted to bring back the power of the Catholic Church and reestablish a nation that was fundamentally conservative. But there were people who were anti-Vichy, and there were people who were pro-Vichy. There were those who were anti-communists and those who were pro-communists. So it was a real, there was no sort of organized resistance. Different groups had different motives for standing against Germans and the Vichy government. Guy Mouquet, I start with his story. He was a 16-year-old boy who was a young communist. His father had been a communist legislator and had been arrested once for 1 year. Stalin and Hitler had an agreement that neither would invade the other, and for 1 year, communists then became targets being secret agents. And so his father had been arrested and sent to Algeria. And so he started running around the city with his young communist friends, putting up signs about free Mouquet, meaning free his father. And they were just kids. They weren't violent. They passed tracts and leaflets. And suddenly he's arrested at 16 and sent off. And the Germans didn't imprison anyone under 17. They usually put them in a camp for a few weeks or sent them home to their parents. But once you were 17, you were you could be shot and or imprisoned for a long time. And they kept him in camp until he was 17. And just because of bad luck, the Germans were afraid of some of the resistance movements, and so they started shooting hostages whenever a German was shot, a German soldier. And there was a German major shot and killed, and so Hitler demanded that 50 hostages be shot, hostages being people in jail for a variety of reasons. And everyone was shocked by that. Even the Germans thought this was a bad idea, but it worked once or twice, and then it was finally forgotten because it was such a horrible price. But Guy Mouquet was caught up in that, and he was in prison, and the Germans came in and demanded 50 communists, and he was one. And so at 17, he was taken out and shot by a German firing squad. His story spread immediately throughout France through underground newspapers and everything because he was a young boy, and he was very courageous. So he became sort of a hero, even though he had primarily not been fighting the Germans, but the Vichy government, which had imprisoned his father. So the irony is that he became a hero of the resistance against the Germans, who did shoot him, but his crime, so-called, had been really against the Vichy government. But the communists adopted him immediately and began printing underground newspapers, etc., after he was killed, and he became a hero of the martyrdom of young people, an example of the martyrdom of young people taking up arms against oppressive governments. But even his story is complicated because he wasn't arrested by the Germans. He was arrested by the French. He wasn't fighting the Germans. He was fighting the Vichy government, but he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he became thus a martyr, and many people think that he had fought the Germans and he had attacked them and thrown bombs at them. He had done none of that, but he became the first martyr of the resistance, and it was used a great deal by the Communist Party.
Yeah, and I think especially what was interesting about what you just said was the idea that he was kind of a pacifist, or he was non-violently resisting.
Right.
And then you mentioned that, you know, all these people took his martyrdom and used it for their ends, including people who were violent. And
right.
So I want to think a little bit about the resistance in terms of pacifism versus violence and the different types of resistance. And I know you mentioned, I think Simone Weil, and I want to think about all of that with Simone's story in terms of, you know, how can we think about what's okay or not okay in this sort of thing? And you know, later on you get into that idea of kind of, you know, what's morally acceptable or not for a resistor.
Well, that was one of the most difficult things about writing this book, was what does the term resistance mean? If it has a capital R, which I rarely use, it means sort of an organized group in general. De Gaulle was afraid of the resistance because it was so powerfully communist. They were very strong, and he was afraid that the communists would try to take over the government. And so what he tried to do, and he did succeed, but not until later in the war, is organize all the resistance groups under his flag, the Free French flag. But that worked only, all these resistance groups had different reasons for being in a resistance, to protect their homeland, to protect their province, because they were communists, because they were Catholic, because they were Protestants. The Protestants were very strong, only 2 or 3% of the population, but very strong in the resistance. All these groups had different motives. And the young people had different motives. Their father had been arrested, or he was a prisoner of war, or a brother had been killed, or the family was communist, or et cetera. So to me, there are two types of, I try to narrow it down to two types of resistance. There's a kind of resistance which I use the word to withstand. You just withstand the presence of the enemy, and by that I mean you don't bend, you don't smile at the German soldiers, you do everything to ignore them. And many German soldiers mention this, that they love being in Paris and in France, but they many of them found the French unfriendly. You generally try to ignore them, or you barely follow the law. It's just enough to keep yourself out of trouble. And then there is the actions of resistance, which for the most, and by the way, withstanding could also mean, you know, passing out underground newspapers and tracts and writing on the walls, Vive de Gaulle and things of that sort. And then comes what I call the really active resistance, where, which also includes that kind of visible expression of hatred of the occupier, but then moves into violence as well. Bombings and ambushes and kidnappings. But both of these types of resistance are willful acts on the part of individuals to send a signal, violent or not violent, we don't want you here. You don't represent us. We don't support you. We don't have the power to throw you out, but we have the power to make your life less comfortable than it should be with all the power that you do have. So resistance runs the gamut from just crossing the street when a German soldier comes down the sidewalk to blowing up a German restaurant filled with German soldiers. And I try to distinguish between those between those two groups with my examples.
Yeah, and you mentioned how de Gaulle was a little bit worried about some of the resistance because, you know, they were communists.
Right. And
he mentioned, I think it was in a radio address that you had excerpted, that he called for the flame of French resistance to not go out.
Yes.
So, you know, he clearly, you know, wanted some elements of the resistance to keep going. So how did he kind of manage that? Was he in contact with different resistance movements?
Yes.
How did the resistance movements feel about him? You know, what was that relationship like?
Some of them adored him and followed. Don't forget, he was unknown, but he soon became known because BBC was broadcast widely in France. And some people thought, well, here's another right-wing general. He was like Pétain, the right-wing general who had taken over Vichy. Pétain was like Eisenhower. It was as if they had put an Eisenhower in charge of Vichy regime. He was very well respected. He was very old, but he was very well respected by a lot of people, because he was conservative French. He loved France. He'd fought for France. He'd helped win the World War I. But then he became to collaborate more and more closely with the Germans, and that turned a lot of people off. Whereas de Gaulle came from this, he was a protege of Pétain. He came from the same caste, social caste and military caste. Many people didn't like de Gaulle because they thought he was just going to be another right-wing general. Other people adored him. he was very smart in ensuring as quickly as he could to get his own people in France and to help start resistance groups. But the resistance was so widespread and so idiosyncratic. The groups were so idiosyncratic, he could never get total control of the internal resistance. In fact, the Allies, the British, wouldn't even drop arms for a long time to help these people because they were afraid the arms would fall into the hands of communists or of people who weren't supporting de Gaulle. So it was a very complicated time. He did use the word resistance. I think he regretted it because it meant that he created an entity that was uncontrollable for him. But when he came to France after D-Day, he made a very famous speech when he said France is now free, and because all the French had resisted the Germans. So he created this myth that all of the French had either, you know, very quietly or very loudly resisted the Germans, which was not true at all. But he created that myth, which lasted until the 1970s, until people began asking questions and exploring more deeply the archives. The archives were just opened three or four years ago. All of the archives about the resistance were just opened. So they kept...
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, he must have done that really in a way, maybe trying to promote unity, you know, now that there was kind of an end. He wanted people to kind of, you know, come with their neighbors and, you know, kind of stop staring at each other and wondering, you know, where everybody stood.
Yes, because there was almost a civil war after the liberation, and there was a lot of, internecine violence, kangaroo trials, people being shot, one side shooting the other because they had collaborated too much. And he is also afraid of the power of the Communist Party, which was by then the most powerful party in France. So he did. That's a very good point. He wanted to create a unity. It was a phony unity, but it worked. He wanted France to be seen as a bulwark against communism. Don't forget, the minute the war ended, even before the war ended, everyone was suddenly afraid of Russia and expansion of communism. Stalin had made a deal which gave him a lot of Eastern Europe. And so he was a very canny man. I think he's one of the greatest politicians of the 20th century, a man who went from nowhere to becoming a major figure. He even, France, which had been defeated and which had signed an armistice with Germany, wound up on the Security Council. I mean, it became a major figure. This was a defeated country. And he was brilliant in promoting the idea that the French had always been, and all of the French had been against the Germans and against the Vichy government. So I stand in admiration of it.
But it if nothing else.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, I really enjoyed how you often took the time to focus in on the individual people. So you didn't just tell the history, you tried to bring it to life by focusing in on some of the major players and even some of the smaller players in terms of these adolescents that were resisting. One of the main ones that you focused on was Jacques Lusseron, and kind of his leading of the resistance or of a resistance.
Right.
Maybe tell everyone his story and what made him such an inspiring figure.
Well, his story is in fact, I wanted to write, when I first started the book, I called it Blind Resistance. But I thought that was too limiting a title, so I just wrote a chapter on him. From the age of 8 or 7, he was totally blind. He had had an accident as a young boy and fell against a desk and poked out his eyeball. And then the other one sympathetically went blind. So he was totally blind from the age of 7. By the age of 17, he was leading one of the largest groups of young resistors, nonviolent. These were kids who, hundreds and hundreds of young people who would pass out newspapers on the metros and churches and everywhere, calling for resistance against the Germans. Now, how did that happen? Those 10 years were remarkable. His parents were very savvy. They didn't send him to a school for the blind. They made sure he went to a school. Schools were sighted kids. He learned Braille. And he developed a philosophy, a sort of a cognitive philosophy, which people still read his biography for, which is that we think that without our sight, we've lost a great deal of our sensorial appreciation of the world. And he basically says, no, it's just the opposite. Without your sight, you gain more ability to read your environment. And so, and he did. He learned to read people very well. He had many sighted friends. They trusted him. They found him remarkably canny about understanding what was going on in the classroom or in social groups. He was this blind boy who could read everybody because of his, he said, because he could literally feel the character of others through their movements, through the tones of their voices, through their odors, through their sounds. And he was very smart. He was always at the top of his class, even though he was blind. So he and a few of his friends, he'd been listening to the Germans on the radio all during Hitler's rise. His father had been a traveling salesman in Germany, so he knew German. He knew German very well. And after a couple of years after the occupation, he and a few friends got together to start a group of young people who would resist both the Vichy government and the Germans. And they were 16, 17, 18 years old. The group grew larger and larger and became so large that they figured that they were going to be betrayed by somebody, so they reconstructed it, the idea being that they would only admit people to the group whom Jacques had interviewed, and they chose Jacques to interview these people. Now, one of the things he had developed was his memory, an extraordinary memory. So he never wrote anything down. He had addresses and phone numbers in his brain. He could remember whom he talked to 6 months before. And so he interviewed, we're not sure how many, but hundreds, I'll say hundreds, 300, 400, 500 young people, not girls. Still, they were interviewing boys. And they'd come to his apartment. They would say, go see the blind guy. If you're interested in joining this group, go see the blind guy. And he'd invite them into his apartment, and he'd sit them down in a darkened room. They were immediately uncomfortable because he was blind. They weren't. And he interviewed them. And he would notice if they, you know, rubbed their hands on their pants, or if they squirmed in the seat, or if they jiggled their leg, or if their voice was uncertain, how long did it take them to become comfortable. And he would interview them and ask them questions and then tell them goodbye. And then his committee would meet, and he would say, take this guy, don't take that guy. And he only made one mistake in all those times, and so the group was betrayed about a year before the war ended. But basically, it's a remarkable story how they built this extraordinary loyal group of young people running all through Paris and outskirts of Paris, based primarily on the interviewing strategies of a young blind boy. He wound up being arrested, being sent to Buchenwald, which was a concentration camp. No one thought he would survive because he's blind, and they usually immediately killed people who were handicapped. But he did survive because he knew German, and he came back later and became a professor and went to and taught in the United States. at Case Western and University of Hawaii. It's a remarkable story.
Yeah, it really was. And especially, you know, like you just mentioned, this was a nonviolent movement. And
right.
I want to think about the idea between the nonviolent and violent movements, since both were sort of happening simultaneously within, you know, the madness that was the occupation.
Right.
Was there a sense from the research you did that one was more effective than the other? Or how are we judging, you know, the results of these various resistance movements?
Well, to be blunt, the resistance, not much would have changed if there had not been a resistance. They kept the Germans were extraordinarily successful in controlling resistance groups. They really, really were very, very good. And the resistance, maybe right before D-Day, when the resistance was giving specific jobs about bridges and railway heads and things of that sort, they may have been very successful. Eisenhower said they were worth two or three battalions, but I think he was just flattering them. So they didn't help in the war, but they did keep they did keep alive the idea that France could survive this and that the war would be eventually, by the mid-40s, the war would be won by the Allies. They kept the idea that the young people and older people, too, were resisting was a very powerful motivation for a lot of citizens to just keep their head low and resist in the most passive way, but that at least the idea of freedom was not dead. So I think their influence was more moral than it was physical. Although a lot of them died, a lot of German soldiers died, but not an enormous number. And there were a lot of public executions. The Germans tried to frighten the French people into submission, and it didn't work. But whether or not that was essential and that was crucial in helping D-Day succeed and helping the Americans and the British to push the Germans out of France, I have to say that it was not. What was remarkable was the courage that they thought they were doing more, perhaps, than they were doing. They thought they were being more effective more than they were. This is what makes the story so compelling for me, that people would take their lives into their hands and run away from their families and put their lives in danger for a result which was very evanescent. The Germans never left or retreated because of the resistance. But who knows what moral force does in an occupation? So, I would
right. I mean, I think it sounds like really what it was driving them was the need to do something. You know,
exactly.
Sort of a psychological. You
right.
know, they're seeing everything. They're seeing, you know, especially you write a lot about how non-Jewish people, for example, would see friends that they maybe didn't even know were Jewish. Get
right.
separated from their parents, you know, mothers separated from their children. And so, you know, the trauma that the young people of France must have experienced would have been very high here. And so I think having that outlet and organizing and pushing to try and do something, even if ultimately it was ineffective, I think that must have really helped them through this difficult part of their lives.
And they were, after all, adolescents. And look what's happening around the world today in Hong Kong and Istanbul and Algiers. These are young people. They have their life. They want a future that they can rely on, not the same dull future they have now. And so that was part of it. It was a generational promise on their part that things have got to get better. And you guys lost the war. You let the Germans take over. Let's see if we can't find another way out of this. And so that's what I mean about their moral effectiveness versus their, their military effectiveness. I think it was very important. Probably the single biggest mistake the Germans made, I think, in France was imposing the Yellow Star in 1942 on Jews 6 years old and older. That sort of sent a signal to everybody that they'd heard about the racism, they'd heard about the anti-Semitic policies of Germany, they'd heard that German Jews were wearing Yellow Stars, but just to see it on French citizens, many of whom they didn't even know were Jewish. In fact, many of the Jews had to wear stars, hadn't really known they were Jewish in the sense that they weren't religious. They just happened to be ethnically Jewish. That sent a bolt through of attention through the whole population. And then a lot of young people manufactured stars themselves, young Gentiles, and wore the stars, saying, you know, I'm a Gentile, or the star said French, or I'm a Gentile, or I'm a Parisian. They were in solidarity, and they would be arrested by the Germans for doing this and put in jail for 6 months. But they did it. They were ticked off at the arrogance of somehow identifying a whole group of people who had been their friends and their colleagues and their bosses and their employees and embarrassing them like that, because what's the next step? Maybe they'll do it to Protestants next time. So that was a right. Big mistake of the Germans, big mistake.
Yeah. You mentioned how Jacques' group was exclusively boys. And, right. I want to think about, you wrote near the end of the book about the differences between how women and men, girls and boys, were perceived. And throughout the book, you brought up Marussia and her story and, kind of the reasons that brought her and other women into the resistance movements. So maybe just talk a little bit about, what things were like for women during right. the occupation and what drove them to resist and how they were able to resist if they were left out of certain groups.
Well, the first thing to know is that history was not nice to the women who resisted. By not nice, I mean it didn't pay much attention to it. After the war, de Gaulle, during and after war, had appointed 1,100 people, giving them the decoration of the liberation, only six women out of 1,100. Women were, in the histories that were following, were generally ignored. It was the men who were organized in the post, the political groups. It was the men who were being recognized who had died, and not the women. In fact, it wasn't only to 2 or 3 years ago that the French government moved some women into the Pantheon who had been in the resistance. That's 80 years afterwards. So, but they were very important in the resistance. But girls were treated like girls were everywhere in the 40s. They were protected because they were girls. They were protected by their families. But there were exceptions, and the more exceptions you read about, the more you see. Every exception that I found had 5 or 6 more exceptions attached to her and her actions. And so I began to find, and now there have been books written in France that deal with this as well, that there were a lot of young women who were used, who were very useful, because for the most part, since women were not taken seriously, they could get away with a lot of things that boys couldn't get away with. There are all kinds of examples of them flirting with the German soldiers, of them being totally unseen by the Germans when on their bikes, when they were carrying arms and messages and things of that sort. Now, Marussia was a young communist, and she had joined the Communist Party when she was only 12 or 13, because her mother was a communist, and but her mother's family were very aristocratic and very conservative, and, but she joined a group of young communists and was very, very successful as a leader of and an organizer of resistance groups. And girls and women were used. They were very active. One of the largest resistance groups in France was run by a woman. And the thing is that history sort of ignored them until, you know, the last 20 years. They were ignored because they were women. But they were, there were a lot of groups that had, you see, before the war, everybody wanted to indoctrinate the students, you know, the Catholics and the communists and the socialists and the Catholic Church. And so there are all kinds of scout groups and increasingly mixed groups where boys and girls would go out to camp and camp together and be in camps together or be in contiguous camps where they could interact. And so there had been this kind of generational awareness that girls were just as good as boys, but not by the older generation. And so they were used, and they were useful much more than people, generally historians, have given them credit for. And that's what I try to bring out, that resistance has no gender.
Yeah, that's an important message. And I kind of want to, you know, wrap everything up a little bit here and kind of get some concluding questions to you. And I think one of them is we've briefly touched upon this during the interview, but, you know, I want to think about any lessons you might have learned from writing the book and from doing all the research for both of your books that we can really think about applying to our present day. You know, and I don't want to get too deep into politics or anything, but just to think about the methods and organizing and resistance in general. Was there anything you felt like people today should really know and understand to help them better think about what to do about things that they're upset about today?
Last paragraph of my book says, why is it that we adults, that is those of us who finally have careers, families, professions, do not ourselves, in large numbers, take to the streets and stay in the streets like young people do? Well, one of the reasons they have more, in some ways, they have more freedom. On the other hand, they're interrupting, when they do this, look what's happening in Hong Kong. The demonstrations are still going on, even though school has begun. And so I kept asking myself, do we have to rely on young people to, in effect, provide the energy to, in effect, embarrass us who are upset about the status quo, no matter where we live, to do something? Why is it always young people, or for the most part, young people, who go and stay in the streets? And I got very interested in that question. I don't have an answer to that, except the idea that adolescence is a time when you really are developing your personality and your place in the world, and you find solidarity with other young people. But if you look at all the great movements against for liberation in the last 50 years in this country, across Europe and Asia, every place, and by the way, it's Asian and it's European and it's African, it's as if the youth are shouting at us, those of us who do have the power and do have the wealth and do have the influence, to pay attention to the future, to their future. Pay attention to our future. And that's why, for instance, the climate change movement, is who's energizing it? Young people. Pay attention to our future. And so my big question is, why do we have to wait to be embarrassed into acting by the actions of teenagers and young adults?
That's a great point. Perhaps fodder for the next book.
I don't know. I thought I got as far as I could get, because the question is not easy to answer. But if you just read, when you read your headlines and read the story about all of these things, notice how many times the word youth or students is mentioned. Look what happened right. In our country with the Parkland massacre. A lot of people went to the street right after adults, and everybody went to the street after the Parkland massacre, demanding, gun control of some sort. And then they went home. These kids have stayed in the streets. These Parkland kids and their friends and comrades all over the nation, they've stayed in the streets. They keep going. They keep going, making speeches and everything. And yet we still haven't gotten a result. So I think it's optimistic in a way to thank God for the young people to sort of keep us on some kind of, a moral compass. Now, one of the big questions I get, and you haven't asked it, but a lot of people do, well, what about all the other kids who don't do that? What about the kids who put a bomb around their chest and go in and blow up other kids? Weren't a lot of Germans young people for Hitler? Can't you see them screaming and yelling at Hitler? Don't they go to rallies right wing rallies? And yeah, the answer is yes, of course they are. But they too are looking toward the future. They too. I'm just interested in those who. How shall I put it? I'm interested in those whom I morally agree with.
Well, I think that's a good ending point. That's definitely a lot of food for thought, and I appreciate all of that, especially, as you've been able to connect that with all of the work that you did to think about what happened in the 40s. So I want to just ask you a couple quick questions about yourself. I like to call it the thunder round, and then we'll call it a day. Sound good?
Okay.
All right. What's your favorite food and or drink?
My wife is a cookbook writer and a cooking teacher. And as a result, I have had a lot of experience with good food. My favorite food is still from my Southern upbringing. I never left the South until I was 20, which are vegetables, greens, black-eyed peas, cornbread, fried chicken, which I don't get much.
Sounds good, though.
It's home food. I think everybody remembers the stuff that made you feel at home. I still love that kind of food. That's why I love vegetables still. My favorite alcoholic drink is by far red wine, especially because they keep telling you how healthy it is. And coffee.
Okay, where's your favorite place you've ever been? I may already know the answer.
Well, that's got to be Paris. I mean, I love that city. I like American cities. The second would be New Orleans. My grandparents lived in New Orleans, so I visited them a lot, and I went to Tulane. And I think New Orleans is such an extraordinarily exceptional city, truly exceptional city. So New Orleans and Paris are, I tell my wife, spread half my ashes in the Mississippi and the other half in the Seine. And I love both those cities.
That sounds about right. All right, last question. If you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
I think I would wave my wand and everyone would open their eyes and be able to empathize with others. That's basically it. Have empathy for others. We say we do. You can't know anyone until you've walked in their shoes. You can't read a book by its cover, et cetera. But we do that. And we don't like empathizing with others. It brings on too much moral responsibility. But, boy, would the world be better if we just looked at everyone as another human being. That sounds so wishy-washy and mamby-pamby, but basically, that's what the problem with the world is now.
I like it. Let's end on that. And here's to wishy-washy solutions that I think people can actually start doing. So Ronald Rosbottom, thanks so much for joining me. The book, again, is Sudden Courage, Youth in France Confront the Germans from 1940 to 1945. It's a great one. Ronald, thanks again.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure talking to someone who loves to read as much as you do.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.